guys for coming into this space with some self-offering and receptivity. Why don't we begin with a prayer, O Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, Friend, Beloved God, Great Masters of Self-Realization, Jesus Christ, Babaji Krishna, Nahiri Mahashaya, Sri Yukteswar, Paramahansa Yogananda, Blessed Mother, Dear David, Beloved Saint Francis, humbly we invoke your presence into this space, into my heart, into my mind. O beloved Lord, I gather the flowers of my devotion on the altar of my love for thee.
On the altar of my love,
my listening mind waits in silence.
My listening mind waits in silence.
While my soul softly opens in prayer.
While my soul softly opens in prayer.
To receive thy love. Gradually I am enfolded.
Gradually I am enfolded
in thy arms of everlasting bliss.
In thy arms of everlasting bliss.
Suddenly I realize.
Suddenly I realize.
I am not this body.
I am not this body.
I am not this mind.
I am not this mind.
I am not this soul.
I am not this soul.
Thou hast absorbed these.
Thou hast absorbed these
in thy eternal flame.
In thy eternal flame.
I am forever.
I am forever.
One with thee.
One with thee.
I am forever.
Forever.
One with thee.
One
with
thee.
Om. Om.
Peace.
Begin with these words. This is Quiet Talks with the Master, called Finding Me. My child, you ask for service. Verily shall it be given. All about you shall you find it. You so little realize the great power flowing through you. You're like a mighty dynamo, and more shall you see miracles rise up as you pass on your way. Only love much, bless, and give thanks, and know you serve day by day as I see fit. You cry out for light and understanding, and you cry not in vain. Great truths shall be revealed. Listen for my voice that these things shall not pass you by. You often feel a need to find me in ceremonies, in rituals. I feel a crying out in your soul for some way to contact me. But listen carefully and ponder much on this, a truth which many lose and which keeps them from the companionship with me which otherwise they might have. It is this: in simple ways and by simple means, it is the best contact made between man and his Maker. You do not seek out places. You need not seek out places where altar fires burn or go through deeply impressive ceremonies. Light the altar fires in the throne room of your heart, and there shall you find me and know me through simple, everyday things in your life. Yes, I am even now in the gentle breeze you hear through the rustling leaves. I am in the shaft of sunlight, slanting across the grass. I am in the fragrance of the flowers, in the starry sky, and the soft moonlight. Learn to know me through all simple, lovely things of my creation, and never shall you need to seek me out in complex ways. So blessed art thou to hear my voice in the inner thoughts and recesses of your soul, my child, as I bring you these truths. You can serve me well, for they are the foundation stone for a life lived in my service. wonderful feeling in this space when we can come together and dump the body, dump the mind, and dump all sense of self. Open ourselves up to just simply feel God's presence in this space. Doesn't have to be complicated at all. As complex as we want it to be and as simple as we can aspire to be. Peony, as you're ready, could you please lead us in some devotional chanting? Inviting everyone to just bask in this time together. Let no doubts, let no insecurities, let nothing keep you from feeling God's presence. continue our reading from Master's commentary on the Sermon on the Mount. We'll start with chapter 2. Ye are the salt of the earth. This first verse is Matthew chapter 5, 13. Ye are the salt of the earth. But if the salt have lost his savor, wherewith shall it be salted? It is thenceforth good for nothing, but to be cast out, and to be trodden under the foot of men. Ye are the light of the world. The above signifies that human souls are the most important of all earthly creatures, as sodium chloride is the most important salt for quelling the thirst in desert travels. In the Orient, during desert travel, people carry large pieces of rock salt, which they lick during the extreme heat of the desert in order to quench their thirst during shortage of water. If anybody shares that life-giving salt with another, one speaks of him as having eaten his salt, that is, shared his highest confidence. Besides, salt gives flavor to all food. With human beings, earthly life would be tasteless without it. Therefore, human beings are the salt of the earth. Jesus says, if salt loses its savor, it cannot be used in anything, nor can its quality be revived. Therefore, it must be thrown away. So, people who are made in the image of God, if they desecrate that image through ignorant living, lose their essential quality of being souls, and thus cease to be the salt of the earth, or cease to be the most serviceable beings on earth. Unspiritual souls allow themselves to be downtrodden by the feet of uselessness and eventual death. Ye are the light of the world signifies that human beings make this earth luminous by their presence. If the stars and the moon shone on this earth, and the mountaintops kept themselves decorated with silver peaks, but if no man lived to appreciate them, they would be in the perpetual darkness of oblivion. If blossoms waited and faded without the gaze of souls lured by their fragrance, ever entering their petal doors, who would know the beauty of flowers? Not the hard-hearted mountains, nor the brainless skies, but only souls who, by the light of their consciousness, reveal the beauty of nature and God. Without the light of human consciousness, the star and moon-decked night and the ocean, the scenery and the sun-decked day would live in the womb of dark eons. It is the light of human consciousness that reveals the existence of nature, world, and God. Hence, man is the light of the world. No other living creature except man is endowed with all the all-revealing lamp of human consciousness. Matthew 5:14. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hid. Neither do men light a candle and put it under a bushel, but on a candlestick, and it giveth light unto all that are in the house. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father which is in heaven. Just as lighted candles are meant to be put on candlesticks, so that they may give the light in the house, and not be covered up by bushel baskets, so also souls are lighted with the image of God, not to be enshrouded by ignorance, uselessness, materiality, and death, but that they may, with the light of wisdom and goodness, bring healing to spiritually diseased souls. Evil eclipses the light of the soul, as the flame of a candle is extinguished by lack of oxygen. So a soul loses its luster without the vitality of goodness. Good souls must not remain hidden, as expressed in Gray's elegy. In quotes, full many a flower is born to blush unseen, and waste its sweetness on the desert air. They thought to manifest their good actions among men, so that dark souls may be illumined. Good souls shine with invisible light of God. Good souls make the invisible light of God's goodness visible in their hearts and actions, and good souls declare the presence of God and act like spiritual beacons to lead stray souls back to the mansion of God. The Father is hidden behind the etheric walls of heaven and cloistered in the invisible castle of cosmic consciousness, and he comes out of his secret place only into the temple of illumined souls. It is the light of goodness and advanced souls which reveals and declares the glory of the hidden Father. God is our Father because he is the creator of all goodness, our supreme soul originator and protector. Matthew 5:15. Think not I come to destroy the law or the prophets. I come not to destroy, but to fulfill. For verily I say unto you, till heaven and earth shall pass, one jot or one tittle shall in no wise pass from the law, till all be fulfilled. Commercial priestcraft often merchandises religion and distorts its principles. Great saints are born to expose those distortions and to bring out the principles of truth which are universally true and useful for all times, present, past, and future. But the commercial priests, afraid that their trade in religion will be hurt, always condemn the actions of true reformers as highly irreligious, unscriptural, and blasphemous. Forestalling this resistance and accusation from unscrupulous Pharisees, Jesus sounded a note of warning to his followers and emphatically said, "Remember ye, children, I came not to destroy the universal law of righteousness, nor the ever-true teachings of the prophets, but I came to revive them." Jesus came to show the difference between the true eternal principles of religion and the distorted customs of religion. Religious customs are an alloy of partial religious principle and the weaknesses of human character. Priests who cannot follow the strict religious principles often modify them to suit their weaknesses and their accusing conscience. The principles of life and ideal should never be dragged down to meet us, even if we cannot reach their height. We should acknowledge our inability to follow the principles instead of lowering the sanctity of the ideals that govern our lives. Jesus said that matter and planetary manifestations, including the earth, were the condensed mind and energy of God. The Word was made flesh and dwelt among us. That is, the vibratory power of thought and energy were condensed into the earth shape. God's thought about creating an earth was impregnated with his will and energy, and was quickened and materialized into the grosser vibration of earth or matter. Heaven consists of the universe of rays, atoms, electrons, and lights which dwell behind the ether and beyond the limited power of visibility of human eyes. Both earth and heaven are gross and astral motion pictures of the earthly astral life played on the screen of human and soul consciousness. Jesus said that all these heavenly and earthly motion pictures have one purpose, that is, to fulfill every bit of the law of righteousness as intended by God and his true devotees. Jesus emphasized that until all the laws of righteousness, in all their details are fulfilled. Heaven and earth, with all their limitations, will go on existing. Heaven and earth are made manifest in order to work out all the divine laws of righteousness. When they manifest righteousness in its entirety, then it will not be necessary for them to exist any longer. But being perfect, they will be absorbed into the bosom of God. Heaven and earth are fighting imperfection and are existing to manifest the perfect laws of God. And heaven and earth will never be absorbed into God until the law of ideal living and all its auxiliary laws are fulfilled in the earthly and divine living of men and astral beings. Chapter 3 is called Obey the Laws Which Govern True Life. So refreshing to read these words from Master completely as he presented them, and to hear his commentary on the real purpose of life. This is a essential foundation stone upon which we have to come back to over and over again, is the purpose behind this life. Because it's so easy to get swept up into our life and the activities of it and our role in life, whether good or bad or otherwise. We get swept up into it and we forget that underlying purpose. I've been reflecting on that purpose this week, and in just the simplest words of our own need, each one of us, to embark on the spiritual path of freeing ourselves from all of the karma that we have created and freeing ourselves from creating more karma as we go about our service and our life in this world. This is, in reality, the essence of every religion. And yet every religion seems to get confused about this, that its actual purpose is to help facilitate the path for every soul to free itself from its karma and its bondage to itself, to merge into something much greater than this little idea of itself. And whereas every religion starts out this way, every religion eventually becomes ossified into some kind of sectarian idea that you have to listen to this music, you have to walk this way, you have to meditate like this, and you have to talk and behave this way. And in these ways, you can grow closer to God. And the reality is, for a time, that can be helpful to have that kind of structure and even rigidity through which to subject our ego nature, to learn how to surrender itself, to realize it doesn't have all the answers, and to be open to how God will move through us through this kind of form. But if we stay stuck on this form, that means we have just created a new kind of bondage, and we have forgotten the essential purpose of our life in God, which is to free ourselves from all of the karma we have created, and to stop creating new karma through wrong living, like Master said. Everything will be realized as one, and everything will merge in one as soon as we live in the right way. Isn't that an amazing thought? It's that simple. We often think God is so far beyond our human experience and outside of ourselves somewhere. And yet it is this human experience that is God, that He's constantly reaching out to us and offering us the breadcrumbs of life that we can follow and get over ourselves a little bit. Now, this idea of karma is something that is deeply important that each one of us begin to meditate upon. Karma, of course, as a word, only means action. And each one of us is subject to taking action in this world. It wouldn't even be true for us to avoid doing so. We have a purpose. We have a place in this world. We need to actively be engaged with it. That's how we learn. That's how we grow and that's how we help. And yet, we have a very important process to go through of impersonalizing this activity, of realizing that this activity that we are engaged in needs to be purified. This is the essential spiritual path that all of us go through, each in our own way, but always with a very common thread of what Jesus went through called the crucifixion, which is the crucifixion of our ego nature. And the reality is we're all marching towards this crucifixion. Sometimes on some days we sure feel it, that just to get up and start today again, it's to pick up this cross and to carry it, just like Jesus told us to do. If we would be like him, we have to do this. But other days we get really excited. We're really happy to go do something. We can very easily get swept up, and it doesn't feel so much like a cross, and that's not a bad thing in itself. We should be happy. We should be happy to pick up our cross. But the problem is when we get excited for what we're doing and we start to think that this is who I am and this is what I do, and we develop a whole new set of desires and attachments and entanglements to life. And inevitably, this creates more karma. And this is where we need to meditate to start to see clearly. Because it's these entanglements, these exact ones, which we've been working on for millennia, for thousands of incarnations, and which we still can have a tendency to create when we live selfishly. It's really that simple. When we live life thinking, well, what's in it for me? What do I get out of it? That's the real trap right there, is that we start to think that this life is about what I get to experience and what I want to do. It's very natural to think that way. Even as saying this out loud, you might think, how dare you tell me I don't get to enjoy my life? I'm not telling you not to enjoy your life. I'm telling you to watch out for that little self that wants to be the center of everything and take that enjoyment for itself. Because our freedom lies in our own ability to live without desire nature. It's not without desires. The desire needs to be focused on realizing God inside of life and not of experiencing it through the senses for ourself. When we do this, when we embark on the path of life for ourselves, it's like we start to incur a kind of debt. We can think of how we live in this world and how if any point in your life you've had a debt to pay off, how it becomes a burden. Either that or you simply push it away and you try to ignore it and it builds and that debt gets bigger and it's like a monster. Master talked about in his How to Be Happy and Blissful All the Time that when he got to America, he made the mistake of taking a $100 loan on some government plan, and right away they took the people giving out the loan took $30 of the $100, and he left with $70. And he said it took him more than a couple years to pay that loan off, and it sat on him like a huge burden. He felt the weight of this loan that he could not get paid off for a few years. That was only $70. But he said there was an interest. And so every time he would make a payment, he was only paying on the interest. And this is what happens when we start to live life selfishly, is that we start to incur this kind of debt. And then we do something good, but we really only just paid back some interest. And we haven't gotten to the source of the selfishness yet, that we haven't given our desires back to God. We haven't given our purpose and our activities back to God. We're holding on to them for ourselves. And what does this do? It creates a cycle of more and more debt creating. And so for each one of us, we really have a task to go about getting all of our debt paid off, So this is where sadhana comes in. It's where each one of us has to walk this path inside of ourself with sincerity, with self-honesty, with integrity, and yes, with joy. Because we start to be happy to face our debts. We start to allow God to present them to us, maybe through trusted friends, maybe inwardly in meditation, things start to become revealed, maybe through great challenges and struggles, or maybe through problems that we don't know the answer to, and we have the humility to say, God, I don't know why this is coming up. This is some kind of debt that I need to pay off, and I need you to show me how to do it. Show me my part so I can pay this off, because I don't want to live in debt forever. I want to be free. So I need you to help me understand, where did I take this debt on, and how do I get it paid off? I had a dream a couple weeks ago, and it was with somebody who I've known for a few years, and they lived here for a time, and then it wasn't true for them to be here anymore. And in the dream, this person showed back up, and I had this feeling that they were around, and they were, this, I want to be clear in sharing the story, I don't want to make it about this individual as much as what God was showing me. And it was clear to me this person was around again. I could feel their presence. And then all of us here, we were gathering up a picnic, and we were getting ready to go to the beach. And as there's often a hustle and bustle and joy in gathering snacks and watermelons and ginger brews and lots of chips, we were packing our picnic baskets and jumping in the cars, and everybody was loaded up and ready to go. And I had to go back in the house, and I had this feeling that this person was in there. And the house was a farmhouse, but it didn't look like this one. It was like an old two-story white farmhouse that you would see in the countryside with a big front porch and not a ton of windows. And when I went inside, it didn't seem like there was even electricity. It was perhaps a different era even. And when I went inside, this person was sitting in the chair in the dark, and I could see them through the dark. And I said, "What are you doing here?" And they said, I can be here. I want to be here." And I sat down and said, "You can't be here. We've already been through this. You can't be here." And we talked about why, and I had to remind the person the reasons we had established why they couldn't be here right now, that it wasn't right for them and it wasn't true, and they weren't being honest about why they wanted to be here. And at that moment, this person broke down and started crying and telling me how much debt they had been incurring. And in the dream, it was all about the material debt, money debt. They'd been traveling a lot and doing all the things they wanted to do. And at every step, I guess, they were taking on debt. And they got done crying and telling me all this. And I said, "The only thing you can do is get back out there, put yourself in the game, and start paying off your debt. And the only way you can do that is by dedicating your life to God. Stop doing things for yourself. Stop flying all over the world because you think that's going to make you happy. Do what God wants you to do, and you will pay your debt off. Come talk to me when your debt has been paid." And that can sound harsh. And yet, one thing we've realized about the nature of this ashram and being here is that it's very important that people's debts to the world are settled before they try to step into this life. Because if you step into this life carrying all those debts from the world, it's not going to feel good, and it's not going to work. It's not even going to support you on your path. So you've got to settle all those debts up front. And then you can step into this with the kind of proper placement and proper purpose. And so I left at that point, and I said, "When I come back, you better not be sitting in this house." And we got in the car and drove to the beach, and I woke up from my dream. It was a very vivid dream, and it got me thinking a lot about this nature of debt. And in the dream, it was all about financial debt. And that's very valid. We all need to face that if we still are holding on to that and carrying that. But we also need to go well beyond that in our understanding of how to live this life. We need to pay off all the debts of all the things that we've done that have not served our soul nature, and in fact have taken us away from our basic knowing of God as our single soul and underlying reality all the time. This is what all the masters tell us, is that this is the single and only reality, actually. But boy, we're over here spending money we don't have, doing things we shouldn't be doing, generating debt left and right, and we forget, and we get confused, and we don't remember God in the way that we should, as his servants, as his willing instruments, as his children, as his very sons and daughters. That's how we should be relating to God each day. Yesterday, a few of us, Peony and Bhima and myself, had an opportunity to go to a life celebration for someone that we all knew from many years ago now, who passed away recently. And it was a great experience. His wife had put together a whole life summary of him from the time he was a child growing up in Louisville, Kentucky, and growing up on a farm with 20 acres, and moving to New Jersey to go to Princeton after high school, which was a big deal in their family, and then from there going to Yale, becoming an architect. And having a kind of awakening, he was really into Buckminster Fuller and really wanted to design spaces that would disappear, spaces that so blended into their natural surroundings that you weren't looking at the space to say, wow, what a great building you've built, but rather, what a natural space that facilitates life in such a natural and beautiful way. And he graduated from that even, and ended up in Berkeley, where he was building playgrounds. And he started by building a playground, and immediately it was vandalized in a low-income neighborhood. And so he learned very quickly that if I'm going to build a playground in a low-income neighborhood, the neighborhood itself better be building it. And so he would go into the neighborhoods, and he would recruit all the people in the neighborhoods with kids and families to come, and they would build the playgrounds together. And he did this all through the Bay Area for many years. Now, these were just a few of the chapters of his life. It was truly inspiring and amazing to see how much his life pivoted and shifted, and how at every turn he was operating from this place of how he could be of service. Now, I was listening to this and very much reflecting on how he was working through all of his desire natures along the way. And he had natural desires. I'm not here to say every desire is bad. We all have natural desires that we need to spiritualize and give to God. And so at every turn, he was learning how to spiritualize all these interests, these natural desires and zests for life. And so from the Bay Area, he went to Oregon. He became a city planner. He ended up becoming such a great designer and have become such a visionary that he was a resource for cities all over Oregon to contact and to help with their designing the flow of the energy in their cities. It's an amazing thing. I can't help but wish he would have found his way to Stanwood at some point. I digress. It always comes back to that. But in the end, he had all of these diverse chapters, and as they were all put together in this amazing painting of his life, he arrived at the end of his life, and at the end of his life, he said, okay, I'm ready to go. And he was able to say this with one of his sons there and with his wife there. He said, I'm ready to go now. And Bhima was telling me, he was talking to the oldest son yesterday, and he told him he had been a paramedic and he had been there for many departures of life, and he had seen this before, but he had never seen a departure like this one, and that his dad's was different, and he didn't try to put words to it, he just said it was different. And the feeling I get is that at every stop he was working through by sincerely making an offering of himself and his life. He was working through every desire nature that was in him, and he was releasing them. Whether he was thinking about it in that way or not, I can't say. But he was releasing them. And then as soon as the next one was awakened, he was following that thread, and he was working through it, and he was releasing it. And it was countless things. He was really a Renaissance man. He ran at one point a lumber mill in Oregon and was building all of his own buildings out of the lumber he was milling from the logs that were growing around him, the trees growing around him. I mean, it was just incredible. So many things that resonate with the holisticness of the vision that we share here in our own aspirations. In all of this, I share this just because it's so essential that we each, as we go through this life, keep coming back to the purpose in things. That wherever it is that we're at in our life, whatever jobs we have and families and friendships, whatever associations we have, that we make sure that we are relating to those not just as an ego to another ego, not just as people aimlessly and sometimes chaotically spinning about in this world, but as really active learners who are listening for their part and in a very impersonal and non-attached way, fulfilling God's will in every situation. Because it's as we become this kind of perfect instrument that we can work through all of our own debt. We can pay it all off and make good on the debt that we've incurred. And it's important. We're not here to beat ourselves up and say, God, I'm in so much debt. That's not what I'm saying. But it is important that we acknowledge, yeah, after a million incarnations, we have some debt to work through. That's okay that we know that, because it gives us the proper context to face things head on when they come up. To say, okay, God, I've hit a roadblock. I am not afraid anymore. I'm ready for this. I know that this is the spiritual life. This doesn't mean I'm a failure. This doesn't mean I'm wrong. This means this is my opportunity for you to show me what's going on and you to help me grow into the next stage of the path, into my next step in the process of unfoldment in you. And as long as this is our underlying attitude, and as long as we're sincere about it, it will all work. We will be able to get out from underneath that debt, and we will be free and clear. And it really isn't any more complicated than that, except to the extent that we get stirred up again and we get all excited, we get all downtrodden. Whatever whim that we can fall into, we just have to remember, come back into that space of recognizing, this is God's way of teaching me right now. This is my opportunity to pay off this debt. And in this, it's actually such a simple process. It gives fuel to our fire for sadhana. It gives purpose to every act, and every act to become one of true service. We don't have to fear this world anymore. We don't have to get swept up in this world anymore. This world is our classroom, and it is really here to help us to become free from it and to realize it's all God teaching us, helping us learn, helping us be free. In this way, you see how unreligious, you could say, the whole spiritual life is. That if as soon as a church is taking us away from that understanding and funneling us down a narrow corridor of sectarianism, it is taking us away from our own ability to pay off that debt. And so in this, I encourage everyone to be universal in your relationship to life. God is in everything and everyone. Listen to the music that sings to your soul. Read the books that help you love God. Hang out with the people that wake you up and make you want to choose God. Whatever it is, don't let any limitations of the banks of this world keep you little. I would like to read this. I was so delighted. I had almost no time to pick out readings because we were gone until 9 or 10 o'clock last night. And I was so delighted to open up the 2018 postings from Yogacharya David to August 9th, which is today. And it's called The Family Ashram. Mm. But, well, I don't have to pick out any readings. Ram did all the work for me. With these manifold activities, Lahiri Mahashai sought to answer the common challenge. In quotes, after performing one's business and social duties, where is the time for devotional meditation? End quote. The harmoniously balanced life of the great householder guru became the silent inspiration for thousands of questioning hearts. Earning only a modest salary, thrifty, unostentatious, and accessible to all, the master carried on naturally and happily on the path of worldly life. That's page 204 from Autobiography of a Yogi. And this is now David. Upon meeting his Satguru, Lahiri Mahashai felt he wanted to stay in the Himalayas with Babaji and company, but his role was to be different. To prove to all that a householder, future father-to-be, and office worker could also be a fully illumined spiritual master. Sri Yukteswarji also had a householder role for many years, as did Mother Hamilton. Each one faced the common challenge of how to balance an active life in the world, along with the requirement to maintain a spiritual discipline that deepens contact with God. While each had their unique challenges, and each one had their own ways of dealing with them, so did they rise to the challenge and go all the way to complete realization. It is tempting to imagine if we did not have family responsibilities, how much easier it would be to focus on God. Yet my pilgrimages around the world have shown me that monks and renunciates do not necessarily make great spiritual progress, even though that is their stated purpose. Here is a question-answer time in one of Mother's talks, when her daughter, a young mother at the time, brought up an important point. Mother, now what are some of the obstacles to keeping your attention upon God? Yes, Billy, being exhausted. Mother's laughter. Meditation when your kids are still awake, or waiting till you're half dead or you're asleep. Now mother again. Well, it is very difficult, I know, when you're raising youngsters, and exhaustion is an obstacle. I've been through all these things, so I have understanding about them. But nevertheless, if your love for God and your guru is great enough, and I include that because of what I experienced with my own guru. My love for him was so tremendous. I was so glued to him that I was meditating upon his form, upon him, all the days of my life. And I want to edit that. It's written, I was so glued to God in him that I was meditating upon his form, upon him, all the days of my life. Morning, noon, night, and in between. And I think that I could probably have lived one of the busiest lives that anyone ever could. I was lucky if I got 4 hours of sleep a night for years. I had children too, and I had to go out and work for 35 years straight. And it wasn't exactly what you would call easy or simple to find time to meditate. So I learned to meditate through keeping my consciousness upon God and my Guru, of loving Him, of serving Him, of putting forth everything that I could to promote His work, to speak to different people whenever I had an opening, a foothold. and all this sort of thing. Now this is David again. Marriage and family are essential parts of a healthy, functioning society. We have seen the damage when families have not properly formed, or from those that have not stayed together. Damage to children and adults both. Having a spiritual core connection to the family makes such a difference. Although this does not guarantee all will go smoothly, it does promise that whatever individual and collective karma there is to go through will be greatly helped when a spiritual core connection is made and kept in the family. I'm going to read that one again. Although it does not guarantee all will go smoothly, it does promise that whatever individual and collective karma there is to go through will be greatly helped when a spiritual core connection is made and kept in the family. Children will ultimately respect what parents respect. It doesn't mean that children will always follow their parents' spiritual path, but a seed is planted in the child's mind that will remain, sometimes dormant, and sometimes coming to full fruition in this life. We can think that spiritual parents will feel assured that children will behave, be okay, and not have major obstacles, but that does not respect the child's own karma that he or she came with, or their free will. It is beautiful when children do feel a spiritual kinship with their parents and family, but that is always an individualistic choice. Even a spiritual seed that lies dormant in a soul for years or lifetimes will ultimately greatly benefit a soul who knows how many such examples we have had over many lifetimes that culminate today in our focus upon and desire for God alone. Each of us must find our balance in life to give unto Caesar that which is Caesar's and unto God what is God. What is God's? The aim, to love and care for those whom God has given to us, and all the while be free of the idea that I am the doer, and free from attachment to some outcome. What makes us know that we are making progress? It is the increasing spiritual freedom we experience, even when discharging our worldly duties. Whether it is running a company, or washing the dishes, we feel God's presence with us, His strength, joy, and wisdom flowing through us. The family home is our ashram, and just like a monk's ashram, the everyday chores must still be done. Food selected and lovingly prepared, work done that supplies the food, shelter arranged, and much more. We must work through the rough edges of interrelationships that rub up against one another. Our home is our ashram. What makes it so is our love, dedication, and surrender to God. Let us love the life God has given us, and while we can make plans to build a future that serves us perfectly, we can also love life in that process. What we have right here, in this place, and at this time. The love and gratitude for what we have now open the door for God to create through us all that He wishes to express in our life. And His will for us, even when it challenges us to our core, is in truth pure Ananda joy. His love, His wisdom thoughts, and His bliss are not for some distant future in our life, but are with us even now, when we are fully open to it. This is what was discovered by Lahiri Mahashaya, Sri Yukteswarji, and Mother while living in their family ashrams. This life is a voyage of God discovery, and our family is not a distraction, but the very means by which we attain the universal vision. And I love so much how David wrote about that. This, all of our lives being the ashram. In many ways, I think I've never wanted us to put ourselves into a box of being some kind of monastery, because in fact, it doesn't take very long of living here to realize we're not very cloistered. We have a great role to play in this world. We, in fact, I think are somewheres in between. And the family ashram is a great description for us as well. And so for all of us, this is the common thread that unites us in the path of life. And we should let no perceived differences separate us in that way, because each one of us has to walk this path with God and has to start to realize God as the source and as the foundation of everything that's happening in each their own life. And that is the path. That is the path. This quote from David in his calendar today: for many people, surrender means defeat, but not for the devotee of God. For the devotee, surrender to God means being in the loving care of a most beneficent God who will see to it that every part of life is fulfilled for the highest good of all. Just take a little time to turn back within and to make our own self-offerings at this time, to put our mind uplifted into the forehead, to open our heart to God. Just let Him know, here I am, Lord, all that I am, here I am. You just take me now, Lord. You use me. You lift me up into yourself. Lift me up on your lap. There's nowhere to go and nothing to do right now, just to give ourselves fully unto our Lord, our Father, and our Mother. Let's take some time to do this. And Bhima, as you're inspired, I'd like to ask you to play the song that calls to you this morning. this opportunity now to pray for all those that God puts in our hearts this morning. Let's pray not from a place of being separate, but rather praying from a place of our oneness with each soul, our oneness in goodness, and our oneness in love. Manifest your loving presence
in these bodies,
in these minds.